such a perfect couple. There must be some other explanation.
Why doesn't she just leave?
I don't understand why she puts up with him.
It takes two to argue.
It's not my place to interfere.
If someone you know is a victim of intimate partner abuse, you can give them back their voice.
Call 1-800-799-SAFE or go to thehotline.org.
Let your voice be heard.
Good evening and welcome to Shattered Lives, a lively, educational, and issues-driven radio show designed to tell another side of the story, to focus on and humanize crime victims, to enlighten and shine the spotlight on organizations and service providers, and to assist those who walk the path with us. This is Donna R. Gore, a.k.a. Lady Justice, your host, and my co-host, Delilah Jones, president of Imagine Publicity, joining you this Saturday evening for another episode of Crime-Filled Education. And I'd like to welcome this evening. We have a repeat guest, which we don't have very often. About a year ago, we had crime scene and reconstruction expert Peter Valentin from the Henry Lee Institute. And before I bring him in, I want to say good evening, Delilah, and welcome. How's everything in your sandbox this evening?
Hi, Donna. Everything's great in my sandbox, and I'm very excited that Peter's here to join us again. And I know the listeners are just going to be fascinated with all the information that he has to offer us, and I think we should get right into the show. Why don't you bring Peter in?
Okay. Well, just by way of introduction, to let people know a little bit about his background, Peter is a retired state police detective with significant crime scene investigation experience. He has a master's degree in forensic science. He's also in the process of working on his PhD. And he is a professor at Henry Lee Institute of Forensic Science at the University of New Haven in West Haven. And he also has other specialties, including blood spatter analysis and the examination of human remains when it comes to disasters. So, Pete, I'd like to welcome you to Shattered Lives, and thanks so much for being here with us.
Oh, thank you both for having me. I appreciate it very much.
Well, great. It's a pleasure. And Pete, I just want to let you know that this is our second time around. I believe we had you about a year ago in October, and we discussed many topics with respect to maybe you could call it Crime Scene 101. But I think that we maybe want to get an update on some issues that we talked about, as well as kind of go into some areas in more detail. So wanted to see if maybe you could start out by telling people, in case they didn't have a chance to listen to the first recording that we put up, how many subspecialties are actually involved in crime scene investigation and analysis?
Well, there's a lot to think about when you're talking about crime scenes and how you use the information from a crime scene to help you in the criminal investigation. I mean, the first set of skills relate to really just documenting the scene very, very carefully, because many times you don't know what questions will be asked about what happened at that environment, and you don't know what essentially will turn out to be very important. And so when you begin to photograph and write about, video record the scene, you have to be very open-minded and not simply think about what you believe might have happened, but consider lots of different possibilities, because investigations frequently last weeks, months, and sometimes years before they come to some kind of resolution. And so you have to think about all the possibilities and document all of them so that you can answer the question that comes up later. That, you know, the one question you couldn't have even anticipated when you're actually at the crime scene. And so when you talk about your crime scene subspecialties, you know, once you've thoroughly documented your scene, only then can you begin to do some of the things that, you know, people frequently think about when they think about crime scenes. They think about shooting reconstruction. They talk about blood spatter interpretation. and things like that. And those can't be done unless you've thoroughly documented the scene first.
Okay, well, that certainly does make sense. And one of the things that we talked about previously, and I know at the end of the show for the last one, because I had listened to it again, I had asked you what was your most valuable or effective tool that you use, and I was a little bit taken aback by your answer, but I think it really does make sense, and that you had said that your thought process was the most valuable tool, and I was expecting you to talk about some fancy gadget. can you explain that a little bit?
Yes, and you know, thank you for giving me the answer, because I for a moment I was like, boy, I wonder what I would have told her, but that would be my answer again. My answer, if you ask me that question again without any prompting, you know, what's the most valuable piece of equipment? And I would say it's my thought process, it's my mind, and you know, it's certainly not about my intelligence, but it's the fact that I have been trained to be a forensic scientist. And so when I go to a crime scene, I think not only like a detective, but I also think analytically. I think like a scientist. And so instead of going to a crime scene and simply looking for the evidence that supports what I believe happened, you know, as detectives, we try to be the first one to sort of figure it out. And, you know, generally we pride ourselves on having, you know, skills to see things that other people don't see. And so, you know, we can solve things faster perhaps than people who don't have that experience or expertise. But the true skill in being a detective is to, you know, look at everything and not simply the pieces of information that support what you believe. If something seems important, but you're trying to talk yourself out of it because it doesn't fit in with what you believe happened, well, then you need to change what you believe to incorporate this new piece of evidence. And that's hard for people to do because people don't like to be wrong. They certainly don't like to change what they believe in the middle of doing something. And so you'd think that's easy, but it turns out to be a real challenge. So if you can be objective.
Are you talking about trying to remove personal bias out of the situation?
Well, yes, that's certainly one way to look at it. It could simply be, sometimes it's personal bias. You know, I've seen this type of situation so many times before, and every time it's been, you know, you can fill in the blank. And so, you know, that's your own personal experience creating a bias. You've seen it before. It looks similar. So, therefore, this new situation must be just like all the others. And obviously, that's not always true. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing wrong with bringing your experience to bear in a situation like this. I mean, certainly that's what we value, isn't it? Experience is something that can't be taught. You can't be trained to be experienced. Well, you have to actually do this job to be experienced. However, if you follow that experience without also considering that every crime scene presents us with different things, right? It's certainly unique in that regard, then we're doing ourselves a disservice. So the objective, rely upon your experience, but don't let that cloud your judgment.
Well, Pete, how many times do you see, and I think, you know, this may be a topic a lot of our listeners are very familiar with, is when, let's say, for instance, according to what is seen at a crime scene, assumptions are made when, and especially classifying a crime as a suicide rather than a homicide. I've seen this over and over and over again, and it seems to be a mistake that's being made across the country. It's not generalized in one particular area, and then you have families who, you know, they have a little more insight sometimes than investigators even do to what their loved one may or may not be capable of doing. So then I see families who go through all of the hoops and climbing the ladders to have death certificates changed and investigations started, and sometimes they never, ever get to that point. How can we prevent this mistake from happening so often?
Well, you bring up a very interesting and you know, often experienced situation. Part of the problem, I think, stems with how we interpret the information that we receive. you know, quite often when we are, you know, I say we, those of us who actually investigate crime scenes, when we're made aware of something that needs investigation, you know, there's some anecdotal information that comes along with it. You know, for the person who might or might not have committed suicide, the call that comes to 911 might be from a family member. It might be from a passerby who notices something that, you know, needs to be dealt with by either the police or you know, EMS. And so we get information eventually that is given to us by people who don't have specialized training or experience. But that information gets conveyed to us in a way that we're not able to really understand the source. And so it used to, I would get a phone call on some random afternoon or evening, Pete, can you go investigate what appears to be a suicide at 123 Main Street? And so unless you really look behind the information, well, how do we know that it appears to be a suicide? Who's giving us that information? Without understanding who's providing that and whether or not they have the capacity to really offer that kind of opinion, if we don't take stock of the information we initially receive, we might use it and mistakenly rely on it to form our own opinion. So the first thing is to walk into every suspicious death and without consideration as to whether I've been told it's a suicide or a homicide or an accidental death. It's under suspicious circumstances. You don't quite know what happened, and I'll make a decision for myself based on the information that I see at my crime scene. Or I shouldn't even call it a crime scene. It's a scene, and potentially it can be a crime. But that's certainly part of the situation. And I think the posture that an investigator needs to take when they go into a suspicious death is to investigate it as if it were a homicide, until no real credible information exists to support that idea any longer. And that simple act alone would probably mean that we become better investigators and we create and we arrive at better conclusions. If you start
doesn't
from
the
position,
it seem to be the opposite, Pete, that people go into these situations and that's kind of the last thing they think of because, you know, the other ones might be an easier decision or something. It's got to be that they took their life or it was accidental, and, you know, homicide is much more complicated.
Well, that's true, and it's because of that we begin to take shortcuts. If we come to a scene and within 5 minutes we form this opinion, obviously a not well-reasoned opinion, but an opinion nonetheless, that this must be a suicide, investigators might not do all the work that they would ordinarily do because they consider it, you know, quote-unquote, just a suicide. And that's obviously the wrong way to approach this. Certainly you need to arrive at the conclusion that it's a suicide because I don't see anything to support the idea that it's a homicide. And even when you believe that it's a suicide, those scenes need to be documented just as thoroughly as a homicide scene. Because, Delilah, you brought up a very good point. The families ask questions, and rightfully so. And so there shouldn't be two standards of investigation. We should thoroughly document the scene of that suicide so that we can provide the family with clear, objective information that allows them to understand a very, very difficult set of events. And families can be very good sources of information. However, we also need to recognize that families are not necessarily objective. And certainly there's a component of this where they might not want to believe that the person did this to themselves. And so I can't rely on the information without a healthy bit of skepticism, because there might be things that I see as an investigator, as, you know, the signs and signals that somebody is preparing to do this, but yet those very acts were not recognized by the family.
Right, and doesn't it also have to do with, I believe Tim Pombach, when he was on with us, had talked about whether it's a larger city or a very small town, whether it's a medical examiner is available versus an elected coroner and their degree of experience and who you might, you know, how many people are available in terms to actually come to the scene and analyze depending on where the person lives.
That's very true. I mean, there is a wide range of skills and expertise when it comes to death investigation. And there are many jurisdictions in the country where they function under a coroner system, and so this person is elected to that position, and generally they're not medically trained to the point that a forensic pathologist would be. You might have very experienced people, but you might have, the dog catcher and the mailman serving as the county coroner. And so, in situations where you don't have that kind of experience, well, clearly mm-hmm. you couldn't possibly come to the same reasoned and objective conclusion that a jurisdiction with a fully functioning medical examiner's office headed by a forensic pathologist would come to. So there is a real difference in across the country as to how well this gets done.
Yeah, and my fear is always if you live in a little podunk town and you don't have the resources or the accessibility to other people that are more skilled and well-trained, then your case languishes.
Right, and you certainly also run the risk of actually having the people who respond to that scene actually know who the decedent is. And so they're certainly not objective at this point because they have a personal relationship with the scene that they're investigating. And so that also clouds people's judgment.
Right, right. It's true. It's a very complex thing. I wondered because it's so important to be thorough, and that certainly is your watchword and your quality assurance. Might it be a good exercise for us as listeners to kind of go through a hypothetical scene, from A to Z, if you'd like to, create a scenario for us and kind of give us the highlights in terms of what actually should be done, and we need to divorce ourselves from thinking anything about CSI TV shows and whatnot. What is actually done from A to Z in terms of thoroughness?
Would that be
a good idea?
Sure, sure. I mean, I think the first thing to think about is that the people who are specially trained to investigate crime scenes are never the first people there. It's
okay.
Incredibly unusual. There were times when I was the first person there, but that was because I had the misfortune of being so close that I actually responded to the initial call. But that's exceedingly rare and not something that you could reasonably expect under any circumstances. So the people who are trained to do this type of investigation aren't the first people there. When information comes in to 911, it's generally a call for medical attention, or it might be something that starts out as what could be called an innocuous call. I haven't seen my neighbor in several days, or his mailbox is filled, I hear his dog barking, or somebody sees somebody injured and says, I need an ambulance, somebody's been stabbed, or whatever the circumstances might be. And so the first people showing up many times are not even sworn police officers.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, if you have a situation where you believe that a crime might have been committed and that's what's giving rise to the phone calls to 911, then police are on their way as well. But the priority at that point, if there's somebody injured, is not securing the crime scene. It's not the documentation. It's actually twofold. If you arrive at a scene where somebody's been injured, perhaps by the hands of somebody else, the first thing to consider is actually not even tending to the victim, but it's to make sure that the person who did this still isn't there. And
okay.
So you have to go through your crime scene, or what might be your crime scene, open doors, look in closets, go upstairs or downstairs. You can't begin to render emergency medical care to the person who might be in the kitchen with a stab wound until you're sure that the person who did this crime isn't still there. Because aren't I exposing myself to significant risk if I get on my hands and knees and try to, render care when I don't even know where the person who did this is?
Mm-hmm.
So that first act of sort of making sure that environment is safe to be in changes your crime scene sometimes dramatically. The furniture might be moved, some of the things that, we would want to document, the position of knives or whatever is in the environment. A lot of it gets moved around. Doors get opened, lights get turned on. Our scene has changed pretty significantly because of the first people who got there. And this is by no means a criticism of their job. They have a much bigger priority or much higher priority at this point. I think if we were all to to agree on, you know, which would be the most important thing, you know, preservation of the crime scene or the, you know, saving of somebody's life, I think we'd all agree that we'd rather have the person saved and the crime perhaps unsolved than the other way around.
Mm-hmm.
So our scene changes sometimes pretty dramatically before people even get there who recognize that, okay, this scene needs to be preserved and secured for the crime scene investigators. So you first have to make sure that the suspect is either, if the suspect's there, arrest him or her. If they're not there, make sure that the place is safe so that you can render care. You need to care for your victim. You need to get them, you know, to medical care, to the hospital. You need to find witnesses if they're still there and separate them. Because witnesses who will, you know, are kept together will, you know, perhaps unconsciously begin to coalesce around a common story, because we'd like to think that if we were all standing together and we saw the same thing, we would have the same recollection of it. But it turns out that that's not always the case. You know, we all will pick on particular details of a story, and that's what we remember. And so, you know, perhaps the truth is closest to everybody's collective recollection of what happened. So it's very important for us to, at that early stage, find our witnesses, keep them separate, and begin interviewing them so we can get critical information about what this looked like when they were there. Only at that point can we consider securing the crime scene. And what we did at the beginning was basically making sure the environment was safe. And when I say securing the crime scene, what I'm talking about is making sure that nobody else has access to the area where the crime occurred. Because if they do, then they potentially can change the way that the scene looks, and we really want to stop that at this point. And so from this point forward, no one has access to the crime scene. We now consider, what do we need in terms of permission in order to continue our work at a crime scene? Do we need a search warrant? Are we in a public place where we don't need a search warrant? Can we get permission from the property owner? So we'll consider those, you know, what those options are. And then at that point, that's when the trained, you know, crime scene investigators would be sent to the scene to continue the investigation. So there's a lot that goes on long before you begin that serious, detailed crime scene documentation that everybody thinks is, you know, the most important part of this. There's a lot that goes on before, and frankly, things that are just as important, if not more so.
Right. But Pete, if you're a neighbor and you're the person that discovers the, you know, your neighbor who is in trouble and seemingly wanting to see if they're still alive or whatnot, they may be, if it were me, I would be frightened to be going around opening up closet to see if the perpetrator was in there and whatnot, or they would just maybe close the door and want to call the police immediately. And is that typically what happens? They just don't want to do anything and leave everything to the police initially?
It depends. You find people who do very interesting things when they're, you know, when they're faced with the incredible stress of discovering that something like this has happened. I certainly wouldn't expect anybody to do what I've just described. I mean, generally, what these are the actions of the first responding officers. You know,
okay.
They go through the crime scene,
right,
and they manipulate things. But you also have to remember that the people who make the discovery might also manipulate things and have very little recollection of it. Because if you can remember a very stressful situation in your lives, you probably remember that your ability to recall the details of that event are somewhat limited. You know,
right.
What happened in a matter of seconds felt like it took a minute. Somebody might have been talking to you and you couldn't hear them because you were so caught up in the moment. You know, there are some very real physiological effects of stress, and those can affect people's understanding of what actually happened. So I wouldn't expect people to do what I've described. Generally, this is what, you know, we expect first responding officers to do. But, you know, those first witnesses do things while they're there that change the way that the scene looks. They might bend down to see if the person is conscious. They might shake them. They might move them. They might have opened the door. They might have moved an item of furniture within the environment. I mean, there's all sorts of things that can happen. And the important thing to remember is that change to the scene is not necessarily the product of the actual crime itself. People do things after the fact. And so while I'm trying to understand what I see and interpret it in the best way possible, right, to do that crime scene reconstruction, not everything I see is a result of the crime being committed. Sometimes it's a result of what people do afterward.
Mm-hmm. Right. I get it. Mm-hmm.
Well,
so
I think it goes
back
to what you talked about earlier about the interpretation. And I'm sure, you know, as a case goes from point A to point Z, there are many interpretations of the evidence. And, the, you know, then again, you have the chain of command of the transfer of the evidence. So, I mean, there's so many steps along the way that can be interpreted differently by different people. And yet we're all hoping for, you know, a justice outcome at the end. And it's a wonder, you know, going through everything that you've talked about today, it's a wonder we ever get to that point.
Yeah, it seems very long and arduous, and all kinds of things can be, you know, get in the way just thinking of any case. You know, I don't know why it came to mind, but the JonBenet case and how everything was, you know, seemingly, you know, they contaminated the scene and they talked to different people, you know, all of those kinds of things. But yet, you know, and then years down the line, it's still unsolved. So with respect to after the scene is secured by the first responders, what then should be done in terms of your protocol?
Well, the first thing to do is once the scene is secured is to figure out how do I get permission to go back in? Because you have the ability to go essentially any place you need to because you have exigency. You know, somebody's injured. I don't need a search warrant to go into somebody's house if I believe somebody's hurt inside. You know, they need medical attention, and I need to gain entry into that house in order to provide them or get them out so that they can get medical care. But after that emergency is over, I can't stay. I don't have permission to stay there indefinitely. Once the emergency passes, I need to basically step out of the environment and close the door and then ask for permission to go back in and do my crime scene investigation.
Is that when you have to get the search warrant from the judge or something?
Yes, many times it's a search warrant. Under some circumstances, I'll be able to get permission from you know, the property owner to go back inside. And under some circumstances, the place that I'm in is essentially public, and I don't need a search warrant because there isn't an expectation of privacy. So I have to evaluate, well, what circumstances do I have here? Can I stay? If I need a search warrant, how do I start that process? What's the environment that I need to search? And so, you know, we could be outside for a few hours, frankly, while we're getting that information together.
Wow. And in the meantime, valuable time and some types of evidence could be lost and that type of thing, right?
Well, that potential exists, but in those initial moments when, you know, the first responding officers were inside, and, you know, a search warrant wasn't necessary because they were doing other tasks, did they notice anything that wouldn't survive? You know, was there any sort of additional evidence or transient evidence, as we call it, that you could notice that if we waited the 4 hours to write a search warrant, find a judge, get it signed, and come back, and that evidence would be gone? If I can articulate that there is evidence in that house that will not survive long enough for me to get a search warrant and come back, I'm allowed to go in and seize that evidence.
Okay, good.
So, but, the presumption is that any evidence seized without a search warrant is inadmissible. And so I have to be on very firm footing, legally speaking, of course, when I decide to use an exception to a search warrant, such as the destruction of evidence, which is what I just described. But it can be done, and it is done. And so, the thing that you have to weigh is the harm that could come to this investigation more than the concern about the privacy of the person that I'm now going to enter, you know, whether it's their house or whatnot. If it's important evidence, then I should be taking it if it's not going to survive.
Mm-hmm. And is that warrant, is that a carte blanche in terms of any professionals you feel that would be appropriate, or is that just for particular people?
Yeah, if the warrant is written correctly, it would cover anybody who I would need to bring into the crime scene. Mm-hmm. And so you would leave it open-ended enough that it would be, you know, any sort of necessary personnel. And it is what you would call carte blanche, I would say. And if you write the search warrant, you know, part of what you have to articulate in the search warrant is, well, what am I looking for? And so, you know, when you describe what it is that you're searching for, if you consider all the trace evidence that, you know, it forms the links that we try to create when we conduct a crime scene investigation, when you consider how small hair and fibers and DNA are, the fact that that's what I'm searching for essentially gives me access to the entire environment.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's comforting. It really is. Okay, so you've gotten that, and say the 4 hours have passed, for creating a scenario here, and you have the search warrant. So what happens next?
Well, the first thing that we'll do is we will go back into the crime scene, our first opportunity to go back in and quickly walk through and take note of, well, is there any conditional evidence, right, that fragile evidence that we talked about before? Is there anything that we didn't know existed that will not survive very long? We might go in and take that immediately. But our first pass through the scene is essentially where we create the list of things that we know we have to do. Is there anything about this environment that's going to require specialized equipment? Do we need people with particular skills? Is this something that is going to take much more supply, the crime scene investigation supplies than we normally have? I mean, this is our opportunity to figure out how much of a job we have ahead of us.
Mm-hmm.
And so we don't do anything at that point. We don't begin investigating. We don't, pick up the gun or look at the knife. And that's always, it takes patience and it takes to see something that you know is important but not deal with it right now because it's part of a process and now is not the time. But to simply walk through the scene and figure out how big of a task you have ahead of you.
Mm-hmm.
So that's our walkthrough. We do it with, it can be the whole team. It can be just part of the team. But that's where we sort of figure out what do we need to do, who do we need to do it, and do we have all the equipment and expertise to do that job well.
Okay.
Once we create that list and get a sense of what we have in front of us, then we actually finally, believe it or not, begin the documentation process. And so when you're documenting the crime scene, you do it several different ways simultaneously. One person is responsible generally for just keeping, let's say, a written narrative of all the events. And so, when they're done, they create a report that documents everything that happened with time, with the personnel who were involved, and creates essentially, if you will, the story of the investigation. Another person is responsible for the photography. And in fact, when we did this, we actually used two photographers at the same time. And our fear was that one of our cameras could, malfunction, and we could lose all of our crime scene documentation. And so we used two photographers at all times.
Or do they do it from a different vantage point, in terms of angles or that type of thing?
No, we did them from essentially the same perspective. It was two separate people, but essentially the photographs would be from the same place. And our biggest concern, and it only happened once, I think once in all the scenes that I've ever worked, that we had a serious camera malfunction and we lost all of our photos.
Oh, wow.
And so if we didn't
have... So just as a backup... Yeah.
Right. So if we didn't have the backup photos, we would have lost essentially every photograph for an entire crime scene. And while the other documentation methods are good, people certainly go primarily to the photographs and then use the other documentation methods to sort of fill in the details that they can't get from the photos. And so if we were to lose the photographs, we would be at a tremendous disadvantage. So we would use two cameras. And even before we begin the photography, we actually take a video of our crime scene.
Okay.
The reason that we do the video before the photography is that, essentially we can do the video a lot quicker. And the video allows us to essentially experience what it's like to be standing in the crime scene and looking around.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll do that at the very beginning before we do anything else so that we have that overall documentation and that quick documentation of the scene so that we can show it to other investigators who might have a reason to know what's going on in the scene, but somebody that we would want to not have come into the scene, right? Because certainly at this point, limiting access to the crime scene is very important, right? The less people that come into your crime scene, the less the things can be disturbed.
Are they doing simultaneous narration, Pete, of the when they're doing video? Like, here we are in the bedroom and this is what's happening. Are they kind of creating a narrative as they're doing that?
There's some jurisdictions will actually narrate their video, and I am sure that it can be done very, very well. My concern with narrating the video is that if, you know, by what I'm saying that's getting picked up by the microphone for the video are my first impressions in my first minutes of being at the scene. And, you know, quite often those opinions will evolve significantly as I spend more time at the scene. And so I don't think I would want my initial impressions to be documented forever because many times they get changed. You know, if you ask me at the end, what do I think? I have a very well-formed opinion that's based on my observations. But at the beginning, I don't have very much to work on. And so I would not want to comment on what I see at the very beginning.
Well, that's a good point. Yeah, very good. Okay.
Can we sort of go into another area of question would be in cold cases, you know, thinking you're first on the crime scene or you know, you're investigating this fresh crime scene. How much thought is given into the fact that this crime that you're investigating right now may not get solved and it may go into the cold case files at some point? The importance of preserving all of that evidence for some future technology, whatever may come up in the future for that particular case, does that go through the process as well?
Well, you bring up a great point. I don't think any of us have ever gone to a scene where we see at that time and we say to ourselves, oh, this is going to go cold. I mean, we go in there certainly full of confidence that we're going to find what we need to move the investigation forward and make an arrest. Obviously, that's not always possible. And so this is primarily the reason why you need to thoroughly document, and not document because you see this pattern and you have this idea of what happened and you document what you believe. You have to document everything, whether you see its significance immediately or you don't, because some cases will go cold. And if they do go cold, you need to have as much information about that crime scene as possible so that you can revisit that information at a later date. And when I go and I look at unsolved cases, which I do now, you know, as a consultant, I'm limited. The only thing that I can do is read through the documentation of the crime scene from that first attempt. And if it's not good, I am severely constrained in what I can do for an investigation because, well, there wasn't done that much at the beginning.
Yeah,
if the information isn't there, I can't create it.
And how long can preserved evidence really last? I mean, you know, I don't know what all is gathered and preserved, but how long can it really last to where then, you know, the evidence just disappears?
Well, that's part of the training to be a competent crime scene investigator. How do you package evidence? How do you preserve evidence so that it can survive long enough to be tested? And, you know, you have to consider under what conditions was it found, what tests would we like to do with it? Because depending on what you want to do with this evidence, it might need to be packaged in a different way. And so you have to have an understanding of what the lab's capabilities are so that you can preserve the evidence in the way that allows the lab to do what they need to for that particular piece of evidence. So it can be quite complicated at times. And, you know, particularly when we consider DNA, which is, you know, something we always need to consider as a potential analysis, how do you preserve items so that the DNA survives? And primarily what you want to do is you want to limit moisture. You want to limit heat and moisture so that you can, you know, reduce the growth of bacteria, because bacterial growth is what will destroy the DNA. So you know, a temperature control that doesn't need to be refrigerated necessarily, but certainly low humidity, climate controlled, and dry. And that will generally preserve evidence well enough so that we can look at it years later.
Yeah, that was the packet, the paper versus plastic stuff we talked about at the end of the other show when I actually got to sit in on your packaging demonstration in your class, Pete. That was very informative. So yeah, when you watch this, you know, shows on TV, I mean, a lot of them have. Well, this is a 30-year-old case, and look, we still have this little, you know, this little fragment of fabric or whatever, and they might be able to test it. So, is a cold case considered? Is it anything beyond like a year or two considered cold? I mean, is there a benchmark?
Well, I'm not familiar with a particular time period that we would have to meet. I think perhaps, and this is a working definition for me, you know, a case goes cold when you cease to have viable investigative leads.
Okay.
You know, if you're essentially, if you don't know where to go next, or you've reached the end point for all of the investigative leads that you have, I think at that point, you know, practically speaking, you'd consider the case cold. I don't know where to go now. Or I've gone as far as I can with what I have, and it still doesn't take me to any particular person.
Right.
So, I mean, I think that would be a working definition of a cold case. I'm sure that there's some publications that would give you a time frame or give you a set of criteria that you would have to meet. But practically speaking, when you're basically just stuck.
Right. And things tend to go wrong, too, when you talked about last year with respect to the strategy. We were talking about, you know, dealing with backlogs and the strategies that you had come up with in dealing with that in terms of being able to manage the evidence and selectively prioritize what you submit to a lab, collaborate with other people who tend to have maybe more expertise in a particular matter, work as a team and, you know, advocate and educate. I mean, those were some of your basic principles, I think. Do you still believe in those principles that you talked about and that you introduced at the conference you had gone to?
Oh, I wholeheartedly do. And the more I've spoken about those ideas, the more I've had people who actually work in a laboratory recognize that, you know, they're trying to do something along those lines, and if they're not, they recognize the importance of doing it. And so for your listeners who might not have heard our previous discussion, you know, the backlog that exists at forensic laboratories is, in some jurisdictions, you know, a significant issue. And so what does that mean? I mean, that I submit evidence and I don't get the results for 6 months or more or a year or more. And, you know, we certainly can't sit around and wait for the results of this testing to come back before we continue our investigation. And so many times, you know, there might be useful physical evidence that we just don't know anything about yet because we haven't gotten the results back yet. And so this problem with the backlog in the laboratories is compounded by the fact that we are increasingly aware of in police departments that physical evidence is incredibly important and juries want to hear it and prosecutors want to have it in their cases. And so we're continually looking to physical evidence to push our cases ahead. And so we seize more evidence. We send more evidence to the lab to get analyzed because we know how important physical evidence is in our cases. And so the lab gets much more evidence than they've gotten before. While many labs have made great progress in hiring the people necessary to analyze all this evidence, and it's fair to say that they're always going to be in a bit of a catch-up mode. You know, if they realize that there's a significant backlog, so let's hire two more analysts, and by the time those two analysts get hired, they actually could have hired four analysts, and on it goes. So how do we deal with this issue of backlog in a more constructive and perhaps long-term manner? And what I had talked about was we need to do a couple of things. You need to educate the people who submit evidence to your lab so that they become better at choosing what evidence to submit. And the people who don't know much about what gets done at a forensic laboratory will either do one of two things. they'll either see essentially no evidence because they have no idea what the lab can do, or because they're so concerned about the lab not having what they need, they'll seize everything.
Mm-hmm.
Personally, I
could
would
be 50 pieces of evidence that you can't take all that in, right?
I mean, I would rather have crime scene investigators seize a lot of evidence and become smarter about what they submit to the laboratory. Because when we seize evidence, it all doesn't go to the laboratory. We bring it to, you know, wherever our police department is, and it's stored in our property room. And then from there, we make decisions about what we send to the forensic lab. So I would rather them seize as much evidence as they possibly can. I mean, the only, you know, cost factor is really the space needed to house all this evidence, which
yeah.
certainly is a significant cost, but it certainly is less than having unsolved crimes. So, you know, get the
yeah.
space, seize the evidence. And then
to catch 22.
Right. The second part is, you know, let's get smarter about what we send to the lab. And so I talked about collaboration there. And so
mm-hmm.
the people who do this work on a regular basis should have a very good understanding of not only what the lab can do, that's the education component of this, but they should also know who the people are who actually perform these analyses. So if you're considering at a crime scene, this is some interesting trace evidence, you know, how should I best package it, or should I even be concerned about it? Can my laboratory do something about it or with it? I should know who to call. So I could speak to the trace analyst who would actually be receiving that evidence if I did seize it and discuss it while it's still there.
Right.
Not only are we getting smarter about what we send, but we also form the relationships so that when we do confront or we are confronted by situations that we haven't encountered before, we have a pool of talented people who speak on a regular basis to work through these issues. We get smarter about mm-hmm. what we collect. We get more careful and intelligent about what we submit, and also in terms of interpreting the results. You know, one big problem that we have is that many times the people receiving the information from the forensic laboratory don't quite know how to integrate that information into the investigator report that, you know, answers the questions that were asked of the laboratory, but there's nothing that tells you as an investigator how to figure out what that means in the context of your case. And that's subject to interpretation, and that's all part of that, you know, let's build the relationships, let's talk to people, not just when we have a scene that we can't understand, but an ongoing relationship. And then the last part of what I think needs to be done in order to make forensic laboratories function better is what mm-hmm. was, you know, advocacy. So we had education, collaboration, and then advocacy.
Mm-hmm.
And so many times we are asked, both as investigators and, you know, analysts at the forensic laboratory, to do tests because the prosecutor would like it done because they anticipate a defense argument. Or they ask the question, you know, don't you have any physical evidence here? I need some forensics to tie this person in. And, you know, often the testing that they're suggesting or that they're frankly requesting can't be done. Or if it is done, it's not as useful as the person asking for it might be, you know, might think it is. And so
mm-hmm.
when we're asked to do tests that either don't make sense, aren't all that probative, or might consume the, you know, the last bit of sample that we have, instead of simply doing the test and creating the situation that we'll, you know, inevitably encounter later on, we should essentially push back a little bit and advocate for why this isn't an appropriate use of resources. So we'll push back in that initial case, but what, you know, my hope is will happen is that that prosecutor, that attorney, will ultimately be educated by the information that we provide, recognize that, well, we didn't do that for a very good reason, here's what it is. Or certainly we can perform that test, but you're not going to get, you know, the conclusive information that you believe you will.
Right.
So,
well,
you know,
isn't
we need
it
to,
a matter of, it's not there, it's not your, your job to it's your job to solve the case. It's not your job to make, you know, to make the legal case. I mean, that's, they're two separate things, aren't they?
They are, right. I mean, we certainly carry it to a certain threshold, right? So it's, you know, we carry it to probable cause, and that's the threshold we need to meet in order to get an arrest warrant approved.
Mm-hmm.
And then the prosecutor from that point needs to move it, you know, to proof beyond a reasonable doubt if it does go to trial. And I think if we had a choice to make, it would make more sense for the attorney in the case to, you know, have the lab analyst testify about why a particular test was not done, you know, as to why it wasn't probative, as to why it wouldn't have yielded, you know, usable information, than to simply reflexively perform the test to preempt a defense argument.
Yeah.
And the more that gets done, the more we begin to manage people's expectations about what forensic science can do. And so I'll give you an example of how this went wrong. If your listeners are aware of the Casey Anthony trial in Florida, which I guess was about 2.5 years ago now, there's, you know, significant discussion about, you know, DNA evidence that might have been on duct tape and other items found where Kaylee's body was discovered. And those results were not very useful at all. There was no DNA that was found on the duct tape, and so that was used by the defense to make the argument that, well, Casey couldn't have used the duct tape because her DNA wasn't left on the tape. And if that tape was found inside of a house under normal environmental conditions, I would agree that's, you know, one reasonable conclusion. But the fact that that duct tape was found outside in the hot Florida sun in a swampy area after it had been out there for, by all estimates, would be about 4 months, there wouldn't have been any DNA to be found anywhere.
But they conveniently forgot to mention that.
and they might have. I mean, I actually watched as much of the trial as I could fit into my day. But even if it was mentioned, it was lost amidst the fact that the DNA wasn't there. And so it was a clear case where we didn't manage the expectations of the jury. You have to explain that DNA is great information, but it doesn't always exist to help.
And didn't you say that 30 to 40%? I'm sorry. Didn't you say that 30 to 40% of the cases are only solved with DNA, or is it the opposite? I seem to remember that percentage.
Oh yeah, it's actually that 20% of the cases have DNA that's of probative value, and that number I'm sure has changed by this point. But I mean, I think the thing that you should walk away understanding is that DNA does not always solve the case. And in fact, it rarely does. Sometimes it does, and when it does, it's incredibly valuable, but it won't always do that.
Mm-hmm.
But people have been, you know, conditioned by listening to DNA being discussed in the media so often that, oh, in every case, there must be DNA and it must be conclusive. And that's just simply not true.
No. That's true. Well, you know, this hour is flying by. We've got about 6 minutes to our show, and I'm wondering with respect to tying some of this in terms of crime victims and their expectations. And I know we've talked about this in a number of different ways, but if somebody has a case involving their family, whether it's a cold case, and knowing what is the best way for them to proceed with respect to if it is a cold case and they really have things to offer and they want to kind of move it along, what should they be doing if they feel like they're encountering barriers with the first line of defense, their local police department? We have colleagues that we know that have taken on the charge and, you know, brought it way beyond because they feel as if the people that were there in the first line of defense were not as competent and brought it to the media or different investigators. What practically should family members do, Pete?
Well, I think the first thing to do is to ensure that you have a fresh perspective being brought to the case. You know, very often when I look at cold cases, what you will find somewhere in the very beginning of the investigation is a wrong decision or an assumption that was taken as fact. And it turned the investigation in a particular direction, and because that information was misinterpreted, it obviously led the investigation astray. And so if you really want to, you know, sort of reinvigorate a cold case, you start from the very beginning. and you question everything that you believe about that case. And so you essentially call into question every piece of information that you've gathered about the case to make sure it's as strong as you initially thought it was. And quite often when we discuss cases, our facts get mixed up with our opinions.
Mm-hmm.
And so something that was essentially my opinion because of the way that I conveyed it would be misinterpreted as fact, and so somebody used that information and ran with it, and it turned out to be wrong.
So someone new with fresh eyes has to look at it and maybe create,
fresh
perspective.
Start from the very beginning and question everything. The second very practical consideration is that when you have witnesses in cold cases, if they were, let's say, we'll be very kind about this, if they were less than forthcoming during their first interviews or during their initial interviews in the investigation, whatever their motivation was for not being forthcoming might have changed.
Sure.
You know, relationships change. And so the person who didn't want to tell you what really happened because they had an allegiance with whoever it was that they were protecting now hates that person. And so they're more than willing to talk to you if you just go back and introduce yourself.
Okay, that's important.
It is. The thing to remember is relationships change, and you never know who is now interested in settling the score, who's not interested in perpetuating a lie any longer. And so go back and talk to everybody again.
Sure. Is there a third point? We got about 2 minutes.
Oh, goodness. I think those 2 points.
Goodness, you're going to have to come back and continue. Okay.
those two points take you a very long way in breathing life into a cold case.
Okay. That is good practical advice. Hopefully we can pass that along. Is there a parting message with regard to the information we've covered thus far today that you would like to impart to people? And then, like I said, maybe we can continue the conversation, in another few months. We can go at it from another aspect.
Sure. I mean, I think what I'd like your listeners to understand is that a crime scene investigation is a very tedious, detailed, time-consuming process, and it needs to be done that way so that we are equipped to answer questions that we can't even anticipate at the time that we're doing this documentation. And so the more experience somebody gets, the longer this task takes, but it needs to be that long and drawn out so that we are prepared for those cases that aren't as they initially appear. There's also a practical limit to how much forensic science can help us, because not everything can be solved by the use of DNA or by the location and identification of fingerprints. Sometimes that information just doesn't exist to the point where we can always find it. So
we go back to the traditional methods of interviewing people, going reviewing evidence, that kind of thing, right?
This is absolutely a collaborative effort. And so, yes, you need to be still very, very adept at doing what, the old-fashioned, and they're not old-fashioned, the things that we absolutely need to do on every case. But, yes, it's a partnership in that regard.
Right. Well, with that, we're going to have to unfortunately close out for this episode, Pete, but please do stay in touch. We're going to write a showcase blog and feature this soon. And I'd like to thank you so much for everything you had to offer today. Delilah, thank you so much. So we're going to have to say good evening to everyone, and we look forward to next week's episode. And thank all of our friends at Henry Lee Institute as well, Pete. So you have a good day, and thank you so much again for being with us. We appreciate it on Chattered Lives.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Mommy said it's our secret.
Who will believe me?
I'm just a kid.
If I'm good and behave myself, everything will be okay.
Daddy works so hard, we have to help him by being good.
If my friends found out, I would die of embarrassment.
A child in an abusive household can feel helpless and without a voice. Learn to notice the signs and speak for them.
Call 1-800-799-SAFE or go to thehotline.org.
Let your voice be heard.